Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host, Han Tran. Han, how are you this evening?
I'm doing fantastic, Jim. Just fantastic. How are yourself?
Doing good. And actually, we have the privilege to obviously, this is Straight Talk, episode number 75. Can you believe that? 75 shows, Han. Amazing.
Yes.
We have the privilege to have with us Mr. Nate Cobb, principal at Thorson Baker & Associates, an engineering firm that I have actually worked with since inception, when you guys started your office many, many, many years ago. Worked with you and your team, and Nate is going to be our guest tonight. We're going to discuss everything, or at least some aspects of the HVAC engineering when it comes to dental office. So good evening, Nate, and welcome.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for having me on this evening.
We're actually very thankful to you because, you know, we tout you as the expert. Han and I, you know, we're architects, we're designers. We don't know anything about this stuff. We rely on you and your team to solve the hard problems and all those things that have to be, you know, the math and the calculations and those issues that, well, they just make my head hurt. I'm not sure. They really do. But, you know, Nate, tell us a little bit about just Thorson Baker in itself. You guys work all over the country. I think you actually over the world, don't you?
Yeah, all over the North American continent, anyway. Thorson Baker's been around since 1997, and we are registered as engineers in 49 states in Puerto Rico and several locations in Canada as well. We, as you said, we are a multidisciplined engineering firm. We also offer structural engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical, plumbing, technology design, and civil engineering services, as well as building and commissioning startup services as well. So we've been around for a while. It's a really neat company because we work in quite a few different markets, including healthcare, dental offices, animal care, and just about anything you can think of. We've got a studio probably that specializes in doing that sort of work.
Oh, that's cool. That is cool. Well, Han, let's jump into some of the discussions. I know one of the hotter topics that we that you've been seeing, and we talked a little bit about in our previous shows, it has to do with this negative pressure wheel. Let's talk a little bit about that. What have you seen?
Terrific. Now, as Jim mentioned, Nate is the principal at the firm, but Nate is also the mechanical engineer. So this is right up his alley. There's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of information thrown around the topic of negative pressure rooms. And could you kind of break it down of what the negative pressure room is, what it's used for, you know, the intent of, you know, of how it's designed and all the good stuff that they associate with dentist office. Our research so far have not come up with a definitive, this is the, you know, this is the requirement. There's recommendation. Mm-hmm. I think you provide us with some support information from ASHRAE about that, but we have not. But the chatter is almost like this is something that's a must-have. So I'll give you the floor. Can I explain about what it is and the benefits and the, you know, the pros and cons of the negative pressure room? All yours.
Sure. Yeah. When it comes to The hot topic of the day, which I think is the spread of viruses and bacteria today, this is becoming something that's more and more in the forefront of everyone's minds as it relates not only to the general medical field, but also here in the dental industry. It's long been an important factor in the healthcare industry when trying to protect whether it's patients or staff from the spread of bacteria and viruses to figure out how to deal with these germs and bacteria. And one of the aspects, as you said, is a negative pressure room. The idea being that if the virus or bacteria escapes from a sick patient, how to make sure that that does not spread throughout the facility and potentially start infecting surfaces and other patients. So the very simple concept of a negative pressure room is to try to take that air that may be contaminated by the patient and make sure that it doesn't spread outside the confines of whatever, you know, area or boundaries you've set up for that. So when we talk about negative pressure, we're talking about making sure that air stays within that boundary in relationship to the boundaries around it. So the simple thing to picture in your mind may be just a single room with an exhaust fan in it, and air is being pulled into that room and directly outside. That room is negative in pressure with relationship to the rooms around it where it's drawing air into it, and air is not coming out of that room and spreading into other areas.
So, Nate, so we understand, and we talked a little bit about this before, negative air pressurization in a room is really designed for smaller or at least confined areas within a building, and it's not designed or practical to negative pressure, for example, a whole dental office, is it?
Yeah, I mean, if theoretically, you could do that. You could make the whole dental office negative in relationship to the outdoors. But negative pressure normally means that you're trying to isolate a particular area and keep it negative in relationship to other areas within a building. So you could make an entire building negative to the outdoors. But if it's all negative, the air is still going to transfer evenly throughout that building potentially because they're all the same negative pressure. So ideally, what you're trying to do is take a patient who potentially has, you know, some sort of illness that you don't want to transfer, put them in that room, and then make sure that it doesn't get out of that room by negatively pressurizing that room.
So containing, so effectively, you're containing the contaminant within the area and then dealing with it. So the idea of negative pressuring the whole building actually flies in the face of that because everything spreads throughout the whole building that way. So our original discussion, Han and I had talked about is, okay, if you're going to negative pressure anything, just do the operatories. Get those operatories with doors on them and just do the operatories themselves. Treat each operatory as an individual component and, you know, negative pressure it. Get it out of the total HVAC system throughout the rest of the building, either by exhaust fans or all those other technical things. And it's pretty complicated actually to do, isn't it? To be able to negative pressure a room properly.
It absolutely is, especially in a standard dental office type environment, which typically have more open concepts, don't have, you know, floor to ceiling sealed off rooms. It becomes much more of a challenge than you would typically do in a medical setting where things are from the get-go sealed off. In the same fashion, there are such things as positive pressure rooms where in, let's say, a surgery suite where you want to make sure that while a patient is being operated on, that things don't potentially get into that room and hurt the patient while surgery is being done. You may potentially want to positively pressurize the room to make sure that viruses don't get in. So it's really important to understand from a process standpoint what you're trying to accomplish. Are you trying to keep a sickness in the room and make sure it doesn't get out, or are you trying to make sure that a sickness doesn't potentially come into a room? And it's just important to understand, you know, what you're trying to accomplish and then tackle that from an architecture and an HVAC standpoint to, you know, achieve that goal.
All Right. And it's really complicated because the other aspect of it is, it, especially with this virus, you don't know if you're contagious because of this particular virus and others that might come down the road. You may be an individual that doesn't have any symptoms, but you're actually a carrier. And you haven't shown those symptoms yet, but you're contagious and you've got this pathogen. And so you go into you go into the building first. You're breathing, so you're spreading the pathogen throughout the building. Then as you go into the operatory and they fire up some equipment and start working in your mouth, then all the aerosols get spread all over the place, which just magnifies hugely the amount of spread of the potential pathogen throughout that operatory. And you could be contagious and not even have a single symptom. So you almost have to treat every person coming into the building as a contagious person, even though they may not be contagious.
Absolutely. And so one of the major challenges associated with, I think, dental care is how to get patients in and out of the building to the respective spots where they're getting treatment, and trying to minimize the amount of potential infection they can spread on their journey from the front door to wherever the treatment is being done and then out of the building. And I know that doctor's offices have been, challenged with this for many years, and some of them have started actually separating even waiting rooms for, sick patients. You go to this waiting room where well patients go to that. Dental offices are a bit different because you're assuming everybody coming through the door as well, so you don't have the benefit of the doubt of knowing right away how to separate those. So that's certainly a challenge.
Yeah, and right now you don't have testing, unfortunately. Even in the state of Ohio, you're not allowed to. They legally can't, where they can test you right on the spot and see if you actually even have the virus or not. Han, you were going to say something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, Jim. Okay, kind of catch 22. If you don't test them, you can face litigation. You test them, you can face litigation. You're kind of, you're not sure which way to go. Nate, right, currently, and you touched on it, is that the majority of the dental practices are somewhat open concept. Treatment rooms don't have doors. Some have open bays, but in general, it's a wide open space. They may have a room or two that have doors for, the more skirmish or the more, they call them screamers. So those rooms are quiet rooms, okay? But in general, they all have open doors, and it's convenient for the staff to get in and out and things like that. Let's say if you have a dentist say, hey, why can't I just make the whole thing negative pressure? Okay, I mean basically the clinical area. Would that be something that are advisable? Because they might look and say, I cannot put doors on in my existing treatment room because the one is too, I don't have the wall space, but the room is too narrow. It costs too much. I talked to a contractor today, and we went through this, this whole discussion too. What if you put doors on? How much does it cost for the doors? And you say typically you're looking at around $1,000 to $1,200 a door. Okay, so if you have 6 treatment rooms, that's 12 doors. Okay, so it adds up. That is before you do anything mechanically. Okay, so
right.
in saving money, somewhat short-term thinking, that they say, why can't I just simply make my clinical space or area more isolated and become negative pressure? Would that be an advisable or an appropriate thing to approach?
Well, to achieve a true negative pressure that is going to be something that would be akin to what you find in AIA medical standards, I think just going in and throwing some doors in and some general partitions is not going to achieve any sort of real pressurization differences between spaces. You really have to have a solid seal, and you've got to really move a considerable amount of air in order to make sure that the air is just moving one direction and not potentially, you know, spreading throughout a space. You know, air movement is tricky. It wants to spread out. If you picture just turning a shower on in the bathroom, within a few minutes, the whole thing is filled up with fog. Air is going to, you know, just disseminate with the general HVAC system and people moving around. So, I mean, I could see a scenario where you could isolate, you know, each dental chair by its own set of four walls and a sealed door, and you could design an HVAC system to isolate each of those rooms' negative pressure. That's not something that would be simple for an existing space, though, just because of the considerable amount of ventilation and exhaust and cost probably associated with doing that. So could it be done? Yes. Is it going to be a simple retrofit? Usually the answer is going to be no. So there, you know, are quite a few other strategies that I think dental offices that are existing and in place are going to have to look at in order to, you know, help the situation out. That alone,
right.
I don't think is going to cut it.
If you do the whole clinical bay, for example, which has, let's say you have six operatories and every one of them have an open door, then you've got to treat the whole bay as one room that you're trying to exhaust from multiple locations with multiple sources of pathogen. And you've got the catch 22. You don't want the pathogen going from operatory one to operatory two, but at the same mm-hmm. time, you want everything to go out, you know, either exhaust to the outside or exhausted to the filtration systems. And to be able to accomplish that means you have to have a dedicated piece of equipment that's dealing just with that area and doesn't, you know, transfer into the other areas. So again, it, like you say, it becomes extremely complicated.
Sure. And I mean, I think most people, you know, can simply take their floor plan and you can, you know, I do this all the time. You take some highlighters and you highlight maybe with one color, what do I want to be negative? And then you have to picture everything else around that as a positive pressure in relation to that and picture how air movement is moving in and out of each space. And you'll probably quickly realize in a typical open concept how challenging it might be to completely seal off that area and make sure that one area is positive and negative in relationship to the other. And as people go in and out of that space, you know, how are they not doing, you know, creating cross-contamination by opening and closing, you know, as you said, six doors in and out of this one space throughout, you know, the course of the day. So yeah, there's a lot to think about there for sure.
Yeah. Now, Nate, you mentioned the aspect of a clean room, and I know, you know, you and your organization have done quite a lot of healthcare work, specifically hospitals and that, and mm-hmm. and high-end manufacturing that deals with the concept of clean room. When I hear the words clean room, I understand that is a lot of times associated with specialty manufacturing or hospitalization kind of stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about the clean room technology? And even if it has any potential use or application in a dental facility?
Sure. Clean room environments are kind of what just what they say. It's an area that you're trying to maintain some sense of sterile environment in it. So a clean room from an HVAC standpoint is going to be something that is typically served by a HEPA filtration system to make sure that the HVAC system is not dumping particulates into the space. It's typically going to be positively pressurized because you want to make sure that any contaminated air outside of the clean room is not coming into that room through doors, you know, cracks in the doors and walls and things like that. It's going to be something that's, you know, sterilized. It's something that when people go in and out of that clean room space, they may need to make sure that they're not contaminating it. And obviously there's different levels of clean room from, you know, microchip manufacturing, maybe the highest end where you don't want a single speck of dust in there, to something as simple as a clean storage room in a hospital where you're storing clean bed linens and things like that. You know, that may be on the simpler side where you're just generally making sure that you're positively pressurized and not too much is coming into that room. So I guess I would leave it to the dental experts to say what a space like that may be of use to them. As I understand it, it probably would be a rarity to have a clean room in a typical dental office, since things are like, you know, all the tools that are used are sterilized and packaged completely separate. So there's typically not some sort of sterilized room where everything is stored. And typical dental offices don't have the same, you know, restrictions and AIA guidelines as a healthcare facility or an OR. So I personally haven't seen it. If, you know, there's a doctor that needs a room like that, we could certainly design it, but it's not something that I've come across very often in a dental, you know, type facility.
It kind of flies in the face of the principle, doesn't it, of that you want to keep the pathogen within that contained area, being the operatory. And if you create a positive pressure clean room in your operatory, you're basically pushing that pathogen everywhere else throughout the building.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, that's why it's just an important from the medical side to understand what you're trying to accomplish. Some patients that are, as I said earlier in my example, undergoing surgery, you want to make sure that nothing gets in and hurts that patient. So you put that room under a positive pressure. You're willing to dump some, you know, you still are trying to clean and sterilize the air, and you're not just trying to dump all of their junk out into the rest of the building. But in the same sense, you're trying to protect them, and that's the utmost importance for that room. And you design it to keep things out. You know, in the negative pressure, it's we have a sick patient and we want to keep it in. And so, you know, just from you have to think about what you're trying to accomplish from an infectious disease standpoint. Trying to keep the germs in this room. We try and take the germs, make sure germs don't get in this room. You know, and we're just talking about pressurization here. Then there's the other thing I know we're going to get into here in a few minutes is how do we actually deal with them? Because we know they're going to get in the air. Then what do we do? So,
the main culprit, and I think the topic of negative pressure room was brought up, is that the whole intent is isolation, infection isolation. Mm-hmm. So you want to keep it within the room. And then evacuate out of that room. So a clean room is, like Jim said, counter that whole discussion. When it comes to, now I'm not going to try to put you on the spot, Nate, but they always talk about, you know, potential cost. When you talk, at least my involvement in my past life in project where we had clean room, that is a very costly endeavor to do just one clean room space. Negative pressure is different. The listener is not bought into getting a contractor who just throw in a vent or an exhaust vent in a room and call that negative pressure. Would you advise them to, our listener to have the entire system look at, analyze before they take that leap of putting in, or even if they can, put in a negative pressure room?
Yeah, absolutely, because no matter what you do, you have to understand where the air is coming from, how you're going to filter it, what the volumes of air are, and, you know, anything you do inside of a building, even just going in and slapping some exhaust fans into a particular area to try to create a negative in the clean room environment, are going to have a trickle-down effect to the rest of the system. You know, where's that air going to come from, and how is it going to be treated, and how is it going to be, filtered? And so anytime you start messing around with air balances, you really need to have an HVAC design professional look at it. Because it's really a system. It's not just a room you're looking at. It's a system. It's as a whole. And, you know, through our discussions, you know, especially recently on this COVID, I really feel like most dental, professionals are going to have to take a multifaceted approach on how they deal with this, because I don't think any one of these solutions, and especially something as simple as, well, let's just put some exhaust fans in over this area, are going to really achieve the cleanliness goals that I think most people are hoping to move into here.
Yeah, because most of the doctors, obviously, you know, they want to have protection for their staff, for themselves, and mostly for their patients. Because it's just like anything. You got to have a clean environment. You're providing the service. Your patients want to feel safe. Just like any particular service that you're getting, or you know, they're not going to come back. And so if they don't come back, what good is it? You know, what kind of service are you providing? Let alone if you, in fact, accidentally allow for somebody to get infected. Well, let's jump into that discussion about HVAC filtration, because you properly alluded to it, that this is a multifaceted approach, and just the idea of, you know, there's no silver bullet. That's what Han and I have always talked about. There's not a single silver bullet that's going to slay this animal, this COVID-19 and or any other pathogen. And so HVAC filtration is another, I think, very complicated component to this possible solution. I'm going to ask the stupid question that I know I don't want to call a stupid question, but I want to call it a question that's very commonly asked. Can I just throw a high filter or a high MERV filter into my existing system and be done with it?
Sure. It seems simple, doesn't it? Just slip in a new filter. unfortunately, it's much more complex than that. And unfortunately, the bad news is in order to put in a filter like a HEPA filter that's going to have a high enough efficiency to start capturing, particulates as small as a virus, most commercial grade HVAC systems that you would see in a standard office environment don't have nearly enough fan horsepower capacity to move the air through filters like a HEPA filter. You know, a standard commercial filter maybe has a quarter of an inch to a half an inch pressure drop across it. A HEPA filter, you know, can be in the range of inch and a half, you know, something like that. And if you were to put that in your system, it would just completely starve it of air and it would not work properly. Not only that, but HEPA filters, in order to be installed properly, need a considerable amount of room, you know, space in order to install them. You've got to have somebody who knows what they're doing, take them in and out to make sure that they're not, knocking all of the garbage inside of the HEPA filter back into the duct system as they're changing the filters. So it takes a special, you know, an HVAC technician with a certain level of knowledge to be able to do that properly to maintain a sterile environment while they're changing the filters. So just simply retrofitting, a standard dental office with some HEPA filters is typically not going to be a simple and straightforward answer to the filtration problem.
Again, then Nate, back to the issue is that you need to have a mechanical design professional to sit down and analyze what you have, so that you can come up with a strategy that can address your objective and what you're trying to achieve, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from a big picture standpoint, we already touched on the, you know, pressurization issue, which in my mind is kind of an isolation component of dealing with the virus. But there is a filtration component that I do definitely think needs to be addressed. And just through our research recently on the subject, because it's such a hot topic, we think that an easier retrofit option instead of HEPA filters is doing something like UV lights or bipolar ionization, and there are some other similar technologies out there, where instead of trying to use a filter to actually just grab on and hold that virus, you're trying to eradicate the virus or kill the virus. So it achieves the same goal as a filter without having to go back and completely deconstruct and redesign your HVAC system. So it's just another way of dealing with it. Let's kill it or trap it instead of, you know, get it stuck in the filter.
Now, if you were to put in a negative pressure scenario and you're creating an exhaust, let's say you are in fact putting exhaust fans within those rooms, wouldn't it be prudent or at least advisable that in that exhaust fan system that there's actually a filtration component, and that filtration component might be where you would want to put a higher MERV filter?
Well, if you're talking about just general exhaust, if that's going to be taken directly outdoors, then no, you wouldn't filter that because you're just going to dump it outdoors anyway. Most commercial dental offices, though, are going to have quite a high level of recirculation of the air, just because trying to provide 100% outdoor air, you know, system where you're dumping in 100% fresh air at all times and you're exhausting 100% fresh air at times is going to be, you know, not only cost prohibitive from a first cost standpoint, but operationally would be extremely expensive. And so even when you're trying to create a negative pressure environment and you are exhausting that air directly outdoors, you're still going to have a certain percentage of your air, you know, normally probably upwards of 70-80% that's recirculating. And that's where you need to take advantage of either, you know, as we talked about earlier, filtering it or trying to kill it or capture it through use of UV lighting or, another technology called bipolar ionization, which actually charges the particles and attracts them so that they, you know, come out of the airstream.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting because so you're saying is, okay, you can exhaust to the outside. And mm-hmm. let the outside do what it's going to do. But obviously, only a percentage is going to get exhausted. The other part mm-hmm. has to go back through your system and recirculates. So that recirculated air, so that you're not spreading the pathogen around, you have to probably more than likely filter it and find a way to kill it. And we're going to talk about UV light here next as mm-hmm. a potential way to kill the pathogen. That comes through. Pond, what question do you have for Nate before we jump into the next part?
Yeah, Nate, this has to do with the equipment, the mechanical equipment, and there is the topic come up a lot in terms of what is the rule of thumb when it comes to designing and sizing the equipment for your for a dental office. I have heard, a ton for every 400 square feet, a ton for every 300 square feet. The biggest gripe that we hear from, from dental professional pertaining to their heating and cooling equipment is that they're always hot. They're just mm-hmm. simply stinking hot. And the reason is we don't look at a dentist in a dentist's office as somebody that, that will be hot, but they're gowned up, they're masked, they are constantly on the move, so they're almost like on a low impact exercise program all day. They move from room to room to room to room, so they're constantly on the move, so they feel hot. Now, if that is the situation that they're in without this virus situation. The new protocol, they're going to be masked. They're going to have a face shield. They're going to have, of course, their mask. They're going to be gowned up. They have the glove. They have the scrub. They have the disposable. They're going to be more miserable.
Mm-hmm.
So the strategy of keeping them cool will be extremely important, more important than what we've done in the past. Could you touch base on that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I would say there's a couple things. One is as the system is being designed, it's probably important to convey to your HVAC design professional what you're looking for from a design temperature standpoint. Typically most dental offices would be designed to ASHRAE design standards, which typically are going to be in the 73 to 75 degree range for cooling. But I know, as you said, a lot of doctors and dentists, as they're gowning up, they may want it to be 70 in there. They may want it to be 68. And you're going to have to balance that, obviously, with patient comfort, as the patient is sitting there so that they're not getting too cold. But, trying to convey what the design conditions are with relation to that. And I would say, just as important as being able to turn the thermostat down and make it a bit cooler in the space is making sure that your space is being designed to be able to dehumidify. When it comes to feeling kind of clammy and sweaty within a space, humidity plays just as large of a role, if not a larger role, than the actual space temperature as it relates to feeling uncomfortable in a space. And a lot of light commercial, you know, particularly probably smaller dental offices, maybe if there are just, you know, if it's a small office with just a few chairs in it, they may just have a standard, you know, residential style furnace in it that hasn't been designed with any sort of dehumidification capabilities. And even though the thermostat's reading 72 on the wall, the compressor hasn't run that much and it's, you know, kind of clammy in there. And even though it's not super hot, it may be very uncomfortable. And there are a lot of retrofit options that can be done to make even smaller HVAC systems like that have the ability to provide some dehumidification. And I really think that's probably one of the keys for comfort as doctors are operating.
Yeah,
well,
I think it's
extremely interesting. Yes.
I agree. It's because I know that if you put two or three person in the same room, they all three of them are going to have or want a different comfort level.
Mm-hmm.
Nate, from a system, the whole system design, you wouldn't want a single zone with a single setting. If you have multiple, well, of course, naturally you have multiple treatment rooms, especially with closed doors, would you advise them or at least recommend that system is designed with the flexibility that they can, each individual room can be set for the temperature that the user require or the user prefer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ideally, if you have the flexibility in your system design to provide individualized control, really the more control you have, the happier everyone's going to be. The biggest challenge would be that any HVAC system is going to take some time to kind of get to that set point. So if doctors are jumping from room to room, it wouldn't necessarily do you a lot of good if you know, one was set at this temperature and the other one was set at that, and you can't walk in, hit the button, and magically it becomes that. There's you know, some ramp up time. It's going to take, you know, typically 15, 20 minutes for any space temperature usually to kind of get to where it needs to be, depending on the system design. Interestingly enough, since I just thought about this, dealing with humidity is one of the things that ASHRAE, in some of the recent articles that they've published on dealing with COVID and trying to control it, is an important aspect. Not only dehumidification in the summer months in order to help control the spread of the virus, but also humidification in the wintertime. You know, you're probably all aware in the winter when your furnace or your boiler are running, how your sinuses get dry. And mm-hmm. I think that there's some thought that the viruses spread easier. You know, we're all used to getting the colds and flu in the wintertime while we're trapped indoors in very dry environments. So ASHRAE has recently published some articles stating that humidification and adding a humidifier to the HVAC systems is going to be an important aspect of air quality to help, you know, improve viral and pathogen spread.
Exactly.
I read something
to that effect as well that talked about that you wanted to keep humidity levels between, I think it was 40 to 60%, but no, definitely
That's
no
correct.
Less
yep.
than 40%, because the pathogen actually spreads easier in low humidity.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Nate.
I was going to say, normally HVAC systems are designed to maintain around a 50% relative humidity, but those systems need to have some sort of dehumidification control in, and that's not something that I see in a lot of smaller dental office type environments. But those are things that typically can be retrofitted in. So I just want to stress that it's not necessarily impossible or a huge cost item to have that done. I mean, it certainly needs to be analyzed, and there, you know, as you said, there's no magic bullet, but there are ways to potentially get your system to dehumidify. In the addition of a humidifier, whether it's on a rooftop unit system or a furnace system or an air handling system, is not terribly complex and complicated. So I really do believe that humidification and dehumidification are something that they really should be focused on quite a bit. And I think from not only a comfort level, but an air quality standpoint, that's probably one of the first places that I would put an investment in. You know, if I were looking to upgrade my HVAC system to help out with a situation.
Yeah, the discussion that I read, a particular dentist was a strong advocate on the topic of humidity, the level of humidity. See that in the summer months, you don't hear people get the flu. Okay, it's you know, you get the cold and the flu in the winter months. Is that the humidity or lack of it affects the lung tissues. It become somewhat dry, and the pathogen can lodge itself and infect your lung. So you want the tissue to be moist, and therefore it had a defense system against the pathogen getting in it and make a home in it. So it's an interesting topic, and I'll let them know is that we had this discussion, because a lot of people kind of debunk him on that. But I'm glad that you brought this up.
Yeah, and actually, yep. Again, it's a whole system concept. It's not just a single thing. Well, Nate, you also talked about the idea of, okay, maybe we can't filter this junk out of the air. Maybe we need to kill it. And mm-hmm. you brought up the aspect of UV light. Let's talk about a little bit about UV light. I've done a fair amount of research myself, Han and I both, in regards to the UV light. And particularly, I think it's a pretty simple system that has been around for ages. It's been used mm-hmm. for so many years, and a lot of people don't even know that it has been.
Right. Yeah, UV light's been used for quite some time just in general sterilization practices. And I don't know the exact date of when it came into the HVAC industry, but I believe one of the first reasons it was applied to HVAC technology was to keep things from growing on the cooling coils, because having that
yes.
very moist environment, bred bacteria, and you would get this green goo growing on the coils. And some guys figured out if you mount these UV lights in front of the coil on the wet side, it would prohibit the growth of that. And so I believe one of the earliest applications of it in the HVAC world was really just to kill kind of mold and bacteria growing on wet surfaces inside the cooling coils. More recently, in the last decade, though, UV lighting has been applied as an air sterilization technique, and the technology continues to grow. There are, all kinds of different applications associated with it, and I think it definitely is going to be, continue to take off here, as, it used to be maybe more of considered a medical type, thing that you would apply just to only medical environments. But now, as we start getting into dental offices, now that we're even applying it in general office buildings at this point, where people are saying, hey, we're concerned about the spread and we want to do what we can to try to actually, kill this virus. Let's not just try to figure out how to negative pressure it and suck it out of the building, because we know we'll never be able to keep up with that, and we can't afford to do that, move that much air. So what can we do as we're recirculating the air through the building to actually, go on the offensive and kill this virus? So quite a few great companies out there that we've been using to install this either in air handling equipment or within ductwork to actually start killing the virus as it's exposed to the UV light as it passes through the air.
Right. Now, the UV light, obviously, that we're talking about for the listeners is the UV-C. There's actually three different types of UV lights out there. There's A, B, and C. Each one of them have a different application, but the C has the wavelength that will kill this biological aspect. So it'll kill mold, mildew, and bacteria, and viruses. So, mm-hmm. But it's also, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's also very harmful to human tissue, eyes, that kind of stuff.
Sure. So that's why it's been fairly popular to install it inside ductwork where, you know, there's no direct access to, you know, human beings. I know you guys have done some research, and I have as well. Obviously, there are some UV technologies that are portable that you can sterilize surfaces. I'm not sure we're necessarily going to go that there in our conversation this evening, but as far as HVAC is concerned, it's normally going to be installed inside some sort of sheet metal environment. And, you know, particularly, I believe they come with a kill switch on the access door to those areas. So if you open up the door, you can't accidentally expose yourself, you know, whether it's your eyes or your skin to the UV lights. It's extremely effective in killing the virus. I would caution anyone who would try to sell you a system that says every single, you know, cubic foot of air that passes by this light, it will eradicate every single coronavirus in it on a single try. A lot of, you know, most of the research that we've seen shows that, you know, it kills some virus as it flies by the light, but there's a certain exposure time that's required. So it is important to have a professional design the system for you to try to maximize the intensity, to try to maximize the exposure time of the virus to the light. But it doesn't necessarily guarantee that every single CFM or cubic feet of air that's coming out of your system has been completely cleansed. So I think it's a supplement to these other things that we're talking about, the negative pressure, the isolation, the filtration. This will help, but it's not, you know, as we talked about early on, this is not a silver bullet. It's just something that can be used in conjunction with the other, you know, isolation techniques and filtration techniques to continue to improve the system.
Mm-hmm. So it's another arrow in the quiver. I can give you actually a very practical application story on this because I've dealt with heart issues. I'm at high risk, and so my sister's actually purchased a UV light system that was installed in my house system, and we installed it in the system here. The interesting thing, you folks may or may not know about the aspect of sourdough bread. My wife does make sourdough bread and uses the natural yeast method, where you get the yeast from the air spores that are in the house. Guess what happened when we fired that thing up?
Killed it, huh?
It killed it. There was no natural yeast in our house. None. She could not get her sourdough starter to work. It did absolutely nothing. Had to take it outside to get it to work. So, I mean, that's a very practical application of this microscopic little situation. Yeast is no different. Yeast spores are really no different than bacteria or virus spores. And it killed it. And so, I mean, we leave the fan on our furnace on all the time just for circulation of air because we live in a 100-year-old home. And so, you know, it's one of those deals where you want the air always circulating because the system just was never really designed to have a furnace or an air conditioner in it. So
right.
I think that's another practical thing, too. Wouldn't you say, Nate, that you want to continually circulate the air within your building if you put UV light within your system?
Absolutely. I was just going to mention that. That's one of the ASHRAE recommendations for improving the air quality moving into this post-COVID world, is continually moving the air. And for more sophisticated systems that have the option for, you know, turning on and off ventilation, making sure that buildings go into a ventilation mode several hours before standard occupancy. So if the dental office opens up at 10 a.m., you know, maybe at 7 or 8 in the morning, you want to turn your HVAC system on and start moving fresh air through that building to try to dilute any potential pathogens within that space, as well as, you know, you may consider, if you have a UV system, just recirculating the air all night. So, and that's something you need to talk to your HVAC professional about, is you may not want to bring fresh air in all night because your utility bills may go through the roof if you do that. But if you've got UV in your system, do what Jim did and recirculate your air all night and kill everything as much as you can, because the longer that air is exposed to that UV light bulb within your system, and the more passes it goes by it, the higher the kill rate's going to be, and the better the air quality is going to be for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to finish my story, the reason why my sister purchased that is she's a microbiologist that deals with a cosmetic company, a very large cosmetic company based out of France, and they use it quite a lot in their manufacturing facility. And she said, you know, this is a good idea and a good system to be able to kill pathogen. Let's try it. So we put one in her place and put one in my place, and by gum, it works. So I'm living proof that it actually does in fact work, even though none of us see it. It's down there doing its thing, and none of us see it.
Right. Just as an aside, one of the things that ASHRAE allows as we're designing systems is if we are using some sort of, you know, UVC system or filtration system that's better than the standard, you know, just off-the-shelf norm, sometimes we're actually able to reduce the ventilation rates into a building because the air quality is naturally better because of the use of this product. So there are engineering exceptions in order to say my air quality is higher because I'm using this, therefore I don't need to move as much fresh air in and out of my building, which saves on energy costs as well. So we've done quite a few designs, particularly in school buildings and things like that, where we reduce below the standard ventilation table rates by use of these technologies and showing through the calculations that the air quality is just as high with the use of these technologies as without. Now, with the COVID situation, I think a lot of people are taking a belt and suspenders approach where they're saying, I want to increase my ventilation and I want to use this technology. I don't want to take any chances. And so we understand that, and we're working on, you know, projects like that as well, where we're not necessarily trying to, you know, take advantage of this so that we can reduce that. We're kind of going all in with multiple things.
Yeah. Now, isn't it really pretty simple to put UV into a system?
It really is. It's really not that hard. It can be retrofitted in most applications. A smaller system, it may be tough to get inside the unit itself, but normally there's a straight run of ductwork, you know, on the main somewhere where you can get this UV installed. And it typically will plug into a 120-volt outlet. So it does consume some power, but it's not like there's a significant amount of electrical work. You may need to put a new dedicated circuit in, but for most applications, we've never really run into a major issue trying to retrofit an existing system with it.
Well, that's nice to hear, and actually very important to our listeners, because we're not just talking about new builds here. We're talking about, you know, a lot of our listeners are in fact already in existing space. Heck, they may not even own their building. They may have a a lease, and they have a tenant. They're a tenant scenario with the landlord, so they have to talk with their landlord about, hey, I'd like to install UV with my system, and I would think that would be a pretty easy approval, because the landlord would say, well, you're not really affecting my system too badly. You're cutting a hole in the ductwork, going to put an access door in there, and you're going to install these lamps. I mean, for that matter, they can be taken out when the doctor leaves. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
it's pretty simple.
Yeah, but
yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead, Nick. No, I was just going to say, I agree, absolutely. I think it's again, one of those things that are fairly simple and accessible to probably most users, regardless of what type of building you're in. There's probably a way to apply UV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of, you know, for those that are in leases and stuff like that, they're responsible for installing the ductwork themselves. So they basically own the ductwork. When they leave, they can't take it with them. But so I don't see that to be something that an issue that they need to get the blessing from the landlord. Okay.
Well, it may be a scenario where you're, you know, in a existing space that already had whatever ductwork, or you're, you know, they're, let's say that they're in a space that they're trying to reopen now, and everything's all done, and you're basically going to have to go, you know, you would go to the landlord and say, hey, I'm going to cut an access panel into this area of my ductwork, and I'm going to put in UV light. It can't be that it's really simple. you would think it's not too big of a deal. And so it's one of those things that it's kind of a, I like to use the word no-brainer. Got it?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would caution is that there's a lot of UV out there, and there are a lot of guys that probably even do residential that'll say, yeah, I'll install UV for you. And it's not all the same. There's going to be different qualities. There's going to be different intensities. And so that's one thing that if you're going to do it, I would recommend that you have a design professional look at it, or somebody that really knows their stuff, so that you're not buying, you know, something off the shelf that you would just get at a big box store and slapped into your system that may be not terribly effective, especially, you know, when we're talking about healthcare environments here. You probably want something that's commercial grade, that's going to last. You need somebody to maintain it. The UVC lights do need to be replaced because they lose their intensity over time. So there's some maintenance associated with it. So I think it's simple, but it's not something that I would just call up, you know, your local furnace guy that necessarily to do it. I mean, you could, but you're probably going to get what you pay for, and it's worth being, you know, designed professionally.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, and because the intensity and the lamp quality is critical. You know, it's like, okay, do I need to run the air past this UV light 50 times before I kill the pathogen, or, you know, 2 or 3 times? You know, that becomes you've got to make a decision of which best way to do it. And you are correct in the scenario that, you know, these lamps eventually lose their intensity and have to be replaced. The good ones, you know, will last 2 years, but the cheap ones, they only last a year. And if you don't do it, it's just like anything. Don't replace the filter on your system, you get all kinds of crap in your airstream. Well, if you don't replace the UV lamps within your system, your pathogen still gets moved around.
Right.
Since we're talking about this, in discussion about UV light, have you any discussion with a contractor and so on about the potential cost of installing into your system?
It's really going to be dependent on the size of the system. I mean, I could give you a ballpark figure for probably a small furnace in a very small dental office. It may be $2,000 to $3,000, I would think, to put a very simple, you know, small one in. You know, if you've got commercial grade rooftop units on larger facilities, you know, it's gonna go up from there. But it's gonna be much less expensive than trying to retrofit any of the actual equipment by, you know, because if you come to me and say, hey, Nate, I want to move 3 times the volume of fresh air into my building, well, now you're ripping out all your equipment and completely replacing that, and it's gonna be exponentially more expensive. So, ballpark, I would say probably, you know, $3,000 per unit. If I was just, you know, throwing a ballpark number out there on a larger commercial grid system, it's going to be more than that. You know, maybe 5 for a rooftop unit or something like that.
Actually, I spoke with a contractor today, and he said, you know, mostly the dentist offices range between 2,000 to 4,000 square feet. And their equipment is between 5 to 7 tons. The price range of the budget should be around $3,000 install. So they're not, you know, and that is basically a general budget cost. It depends on the system. We have just a few minutes left of our episode. Let me get another question in with you. Most of our HVAC equipment are forced air system. And with looking or talking about infections and air quality and stuff like that, is there other, you know, heat and cooling equipment that are that would provide the performance, the durability that would be more ideal for a dental, a dental environment to reduce the the spread of infection through the air?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you were giving me a blank slate, or we were designing a brand new dental office, we probably, you know, want to have higher than code required, you know, just standard code ventilation rates that are more in line with, medical type ventilation rates from ASHRAE 170. we'd want to include some sort of energy recovery to try to keep the utility rates lower. We would definitely go through and outline what areas of the building we want positive, what we want pressurized, which areas we may want to completely exhaust and have no recirculation in. So I think all of the different things we've talked about tonight, we would implement on a completely global scale. The challenge, you know, that we talked about is a lot of smaller dental offices don't have large commercial equipment that we have the flexibility with. We do like we do on a medical facility. But I think that we've got enough strategies, you know, between all the different ideas that we've talked about tonight, that we can really go into any space and improve it over where it is. I don't think any space, unless you, you know, design it from the ground up, we're going to be able to put this all in and make it as good as an OR in a hospital. But I think every dental office, we've got five or six tools in our tool belt here that we can look at specific, you know, places and within reason say, we think this is the best we can do, you know, with whatever budget it is to get the best quality system that there is.
Super.
Excellent.
Well, excellent. You know, obviously there's a lot of technical aspects about this stuff and, you know, you need the expert involved. And, you know, that's why we look to you and your team, Nate. And we really do appreciate you coming on and spending the hour with us to help, you know, help our listeners. Because really it's all about giving them the right information and so that they can move forward and make some educated decisions. That's really why we do this show. And again, thank you, Nate, for spending the time. If any of the listeners would like to spend more time talking about this stuff, you can get a hold of us. We'll get you in touch with Nate if you want to speak directly with him. That's more than fine. But, you know, we're here to help. And again, Nate, thank you so much for that information. I actually learned a bunch of things tonight that I didn't know about. And I hope our listeners did as well. Han?
Let me take that a little bit further, Jim. Nate, I certainly appreciate your time and all your valuable contribution. Would you go ahead and give the listener your contact information if they want to reach out to you for, you know, for more in-depth discussions?
Sure, absolutely. I guess I'll start out with our office phone number. It is 330-659-6688. And you can call that and reach me at any time. Love to hear from you. If you'd like to send me an email, I'll give you my email address. It is nkobb@thorsonbaker.com. That's thorsonbaker. So if any listeners want to reach out to me specifically or if you want to contact me through Han or Jim, we work closely and are in contact almost daily discussing these things. I'd be happy to have a contact through them as well.
Terrific. Thank you, Nate. Again, we burned through an hour pretty quickly. I certainly appreciate everyone plugging in and spending the hour with us. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.